Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill. With natural foods, they support organic, vegan, paleo, and gluten-free lifestyles. Learn more about their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Ooh, I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and yesterday I made a delicious lentil and tomato soup, saru, or rasam, and it was a recipe by my guest. It's Chitra Agarwal. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks so much for joining. We're here to talk about her latest book, Vibrant India, Fresh Vegetarian Recipes from Bangalore to Brooklyn. Actually, your first book, so congrats.
Thank you.
And you were on the show like several years ago. And I can't remember why. We were just talking about your blog. So you've been writing the blog, The ABCDs of Cooking, for several years. And then you launched Brooklyn Deli, a line of condiments that... So you've really expanded, and now you have a book.
That's
so
right.
A lot has changed. Congrats.
Thank you.
No, I remember why we were talking about whatever we were talking about several years ago. I think we had a dinner
at Jimmy's.
Yeah, number 43. And okay, so first of all, flipping through this book, there are so many fun memories of things that you've made, like for picnics or potlucks or for cook-offs. When I first met you, you made a saru, what's it called?
Gazpacho.
Yeah. For a cook-off. And you won it.
Yep.
And then I published the recipe for it on my blog.
And I still have that pot set that I won.
Oh, yeah. She won a cookware set. That was really fun. That was like in 2008 or 9 or something. And
yeah. It was a while ago.
But anyway, so, and, you know, full circle, I made this recipe the original way, not the gazpacho way, yesterday from your new book. So congrats. This is so exciting.
Thank you.
Vibrant India. So, okay, Chitra, you go to length to sort of explain... In the beginning, you know, you're not going to see chicken tikka masala in this book.
Yes. No chicken tikka masala.
Because, you know, when we tend to think of Indian food here, we think of samosas and hearty curries with maybe some paneer in them, which is northern Indian food.
Yep.
But your food focuses on South Indian.
That's right.
So your mother's from Bangalore?
Yeah, so my mom is from Bangalore in South India, but actually my dad is from North India. So,
but they met in Bangalore.
Yeah, they met in Bangalore. So they both went to school there, and so, but this food is very much Bangalore style cooking,
right? South Indian
cooking.
Okay, so what are the distinctions aside from like I don't know those like kind of. Things that you think of when you think of Indian food, like the common dishes, the curries and the chicken tikka masalas and stuff. I mean, are there, because South India is a huge country, and South and North are just really broad distinctions in their own, right?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, if you go to the West and the East, you will find all different types of different specialties or different ways of cooking. And but I feel that even within North and South, so there's a big difference between North and South. So it's like the naan, curry, roti, all of that that you find in many of the restaurant, the Indian restaurants, is a lot of times North Indian cooking.
And that's because most of the immigrants who first came to America were from North India.
That's right.
And that's why we think of that.
That was the first wave of immigration from India was more North Indian. That's the reasoning behind it. Now there's more South Indian, more people from everywhere in India. But you will find, you know, some South Indian restaurants here and there. But of course, it's just not as prevalent as right. the North Indian cuisine. And I mean, there's so much variation. It's just yeah. like, even in writing this
there's
book.
There's so many states within South India.
Yeah, totally.
There's like, and you know, you sometimes see that in restaurants, like, or recipes. There's like the Goan stew or something like that, or the Carolan something yes. curry. Mm-hmm. So these are different states within South India itself.
Exactly. And I in the book, it's because a lot of South Indian restaurants in the U.S., you'll find South Indian dishes in a Tamil language, which mm-hmm. is a different state than where my mom is from. So her language is Kannada. So uh-huh. I listed the recipes in her language, but sometimes if there was more popular dishes, then I would also put the Tamil mm-hmm. Word in there just in case.
Right, right. So yeah. would you say, to be more specific, your book is mostly Bangalore style or...
Yeah.
What is it called?
Karnataka.
Karnataka,
yeah.
which is the state that Bangalore is in.
Yeah.
Or did you try to, like, get a swath of all of South Indian?
Well, I have one Kerala recipe in there, which mm-hmm. is for Avial, which actually came from my mother's childhood friend who married a man from Kerala. Oh. So
he became adopted yeah. in your family anyway.
Yeah. yeah. But that dish is made in Karnataka as well. But for the book, I wanted to get her husband's family's recipe because I thought that would be fun to share. So
awesome.
Yeah.
You know, it's really cool that you're doing such a extensive job of sharing this cuisine from, is it Bangalorean? Is that like something
it's funny because now there's so many different kinds of people from India living in Bangalore just because yeah. of the tech industry.
It's a
boom.
Huge city. Yeah.
So, it's hard to say, but my family has been in that area for centuries and generations, mm-hmm. so I kind of refer to it as Bangalorean or Brahmin-style cooking uh-huh, to be even uh-huh. more specific.
Cool. So, okay, so we can go from South Indian then to... but I really love that, you know, you go through lengths to describe some of the reasons for the ingredients used or not used in this book. One chiefly meat.
Yes.
So these are all vegetarian recipes, but you say that, you know, your family comes from this Brahmin line mm-hmm. and then they have certain rituals and things that they do or don't eat.
Yes,
which is
definitely.
Really cool to learn. 'Cause like, you know, it gives you context to what I'm cooking and,
yeah, there's a cultural history behind right. it all. And I mean, with my parents, they come from different castes, right? So my father's style of cooking may have ingredients like onions or garlic in it. Mm-hmm. But my mom's family, those were two ingredients that traditionally are not cooked in Brahmin homes.
Right.
I mean, as time has gone on, of course, onions have been introduced into a lot of the cuisine, and I include onions in the book. But my mom does not cook with garlic even right. today. I think I have like one or two recipes that have garlic in the book, which I think is kind of different from a lot of other Indian cookbooks that rely heavily on kind of like that garlic, ginger, mm-hmm. Chili, onion.
And onion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really, I was actually wondering that when I was cooking this lentil and tomato soup yesterday. But actually, onions and garlic are also something that they don't eat in really strict Buddhist vegetarian diets, too.
Exactly.
So, along with heat, you know, spicy food and meat, of course. So there's reasons for this, and you explain really well, I think, how it has to do with overall well-being and healthfulness, and it goes back to the Ayurvedic, you know, groups of foods that and flavors and so forth. So
yeah, it's definitely, you
know, it's not just
like,
know,
kind of
arbitrary.
Like food as medicine, really.
Right.
I mean, right? So it's this holistic approach,
mm-hmm.
Including yoga, meditation. Sometimes it's called the yoga diet.
Right, right. And bathing yourself before you cook.
Yes.
You said your grandmother never entered the kitchen to cook anything until she...
Yeah.
What is it, like immediately before you cook, you have to bathe?
You don't have to bathe right before, but just you
well,
have
you
to
said,
bathe before.
I was like, wait, what does this mean?
Yeah, just
I
so
cook
you
a
have
lot,
to shower
so I would
before.
Have to shower a lot.
Yeah, yeah, no making your
like
coffee
like
just after you wake up.
Really?
Well, I mean, you have to. Yeah, you have to. You can't enter the kitchen.
What if you slept the night or bathed the night before you slept?
That's a good question. I feel like I'd have to get back to you on that one.
Okay. One thing that was interesting is that there's this spice called asafoetida. Yeah. And if anyone has ever handled it or smelled it, it's very distinctive. And I could never quite put my finger on what it tasted like or smelled like, except for, and I hate to say it, it smells kind of like feet.
Yes, it's sometimes called like the devil's spice, or I feel like it's either people have a very strong reaction to it. Some people love it when they smell it.
I love it.
And some people are like, oh, it's just awful.
And it reminds me, when I use it, I'm like, oh, that's that like magic touch that's in a lot of Chitra's cooking. And whenever I taste it from like, say, a dose of Ender, I'm like, oh, this is, you know, it just ties everything together in this cuisine because it's very distinctive.
Yeah.
But it made sense that you mentioned that because they don't use onions and garlic, or your mom didn't, asafoetida sort of makes up for this pungency, I guess?
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
It's really interesting.
When it's fried in oil, it kind of gives off this flavor of like leek or yes.
No, it does, though. You're so right. And I didn't... Leeks.
Yeah.
But funky leeks, like almost like ramps, you know?
Yes, totally. Yeah. And you don't need to use a lot. It's basically like you just put a pinch in to the oil.
What is it?
It's
what is asafoetida?
It's actually derived from the sap of a fennel plant. So it's a resin almost,
yeah,
right?
Sticky.
Yeah. So you can buy it in a whole form, which I've done before from India, and then I grind it in like my blender. Yeah. And then, but here in the US, I mean, mainly it's available in powdered form. And I do see, I mean, a lot of times it's cut with like wheat flour, a little bit of wheat flour.
Oh, is that like a cheapskate version?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's too, I don't know if it lasts longer or it blends better. Yeah. I have no idea. But I know Coleuthians in the city, they have a version that's cut with rice flour. Mm. So for like gluten-free people. But then again, I mean, there's hardly any, you know, you use like a tiny bit into each dish. So
that is true. Yeah. So, but it lends that distinct, and yeah. I want to say that Chitra flavor, but it's not, like a lot of people actually flavor.
Yeah.
Another thing that is used in South Indian cooking is coconut.
Yes.
Strips of like dried or fresh coconut is
that's a big thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very popular ingredient. I mean, it's a staple crop that's grown in the South. It's used in almost every recipe. And I usually use an unsweetened version. Like nowadays, I mean, in the Indian shop, I buy a frozen, fresh, grated coconut, that's very good. No sugar added.
Right.
But you can also use dried coconut in these recipes.
Yeah, can I just use a bag of like Bob's Red Mill, you know, the dried unsweetened coconut
totally.
Strips?
Totally, yeah. They have like these flakes and you can
thanks,
even
Bob
put
Red.
Them.
I know, like sponsor.
He like has everything, right?
Yeah.
But like you can put that into a food processor and grind it into shreds if
or
like,
soak it if you want it to be more fresh.
Yes.
And
in like hot water, it'll plump up a little bit. Mm. So that is a good way to use that.
Would I, in a typical household in South India, would you just have a coconut? You just scrape it?
Yes, actually. Really? There's like a, this really cool device that's like old. My mom has, it's like a block, a wood block. And then on it is a blade that comes off of it that has like a circular blade. So when you cut the coconut in half.
Slivers?
Yeah, you just kind of like grate it on there. But I mean, even now, my aunts and my mom, they all buy, you know, the fresh frozen coconut.
Yeah.
I know my parents' house in Bangalore, they have coconut trees. So my mom would actually get the coconut and grate it and then dry it on our roof there and bring it back. So she would use some of that.
Yeah.
She would use it that way to be able to
but
preserve
then
it.
How do you open the coconut? Somebody has to get a like a hatchet.
Yes.
Like
my mom used to use a hammer.
Yeah. I see coconut sometimes, so I might try that. It's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it tastes amazing. And the coconut water in it, even in the brown, you know, that coconut versus the fresh,
win-win.
It's amazing. Which has nothing to do, I feel like, with the bottled coconut water.
Really?
It doesn't taste the same.
Oh, it's, yeah. Maybe they had to preserve it, and it's all weird. actually, that's interesting. Let's look into that more. We're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude and be right back, chat more.
Bob's Red Mill has been milling whole grains since 1978. When you mill whole grains, you get all three parts, the bran, the germ, and the endosperm. The bran, or the roughage, makes up about 14% of the whole grain. It's the outer skin of the edible kernel. It contains large amounts of B vitamins, some protein, trace minerals, phytochemicals, but most importantly, dietary fiber. The germ is only about 2.5% of the kernel. It's actually the sprouting section of the seed, what's going to grow into a plant. It's usually separated during milling process because it contains most of the fat and therefore has a shorter shelf life. The endosperm is the main energy storage unit of the seed. That's where the growing plant gets its energy before it can start photosynthesizing and making its own. It makes up a huge portion of the grain, about 83%, and it's the main source that's used for white flour. When you make white flour, you get rid of the germ and the bran and just have the white endosperm left. It contains almost all the carbohydrates. It also contains protein and iron and some of the other B vitamins as well. It's kind of what you classically think of when you're thinking of flour. So all that's there when you're milling with whole grains. But when you mill with whole grains, you also get the bran, which is the kind of roughage and gives that, that's what gives that kind of color to it. Also gives you extra fiber that helps you to be regular. And you also get the germ, which adds the fat and the flavor, which we all like from whole grains. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
All right, we're back chatting with Chitra Agrawal. She is the author of Vibrant India and the owner of Brooklyn Deli. That's D-E-L-H-I, spices and condiments. So we were just talking about some of the major ingredients used in the South Indian kitchen. And I love that you don't try to water down, you know, you don't try to say, okay, well, you can just use a curry powder, like I've seen many, you know, recipes do. And, you know, probably out of laziness, I would do instead of hunt down asafoetida and curry leaves, which is another one, that another ingredient used a lot. Whole curry leaves, that is.
Yes.
So why did you, were you pressured to, or did you feel like it would be easier? Because, you know, some of these things are not found, actually many of them are not found in a normal grocery store.
Yeah.
So have you heard, I'm sure you've heard the whole gamut of like, well, what can I use instead or as a replacement?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like nowadays you can order everything online. Yeah. You can even order fresh curry leaves online. So, I feel like if people have just, I think I go through it in the book in the beginning, it's like four of these ingredients. If they have asafoetida, black mustard seeds, dried red chilies, and curry leaves, if they have those four things, you can basically cook everything, a lot of the recipes in the book.
Right.
So you can even buy dried curry leaves, but you would use double, right? So I felt like that's basically the authentic, or, you know, that's a traditional way to, make it.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't really a substitute for curry leaves.
No, there's not, I guess. Yeah.
So I didn't go there.
But I guess I see, you know, a lot of recipes for Indian, you know, quote unquote Indian recipes that are just to have one powder. I guess a catch all for everything. So I think it's cool that, you know, you've kind of, you know, exposed more and more of these flavors and what they are, and aren't taking any excuses or substitutions. So.
Yeah. Hopefully not to my detriment.
No, but actually one thing you do in this book and in your business and in your cooking elsewhere and, you know, potlucks to pop-ups is you use seasonal vegetables from here that would never be found in India.
Yeah.
So one example is the rhubarb in one of your achars.
Yep.
What does your family make of this back in India?
I feel like, well, a lot of them, I mean, my relatives are supportive and a lot of them are very excited about this book. And mm-hmm. I think that using seasonal vegetables, though, it's something that happens. It's just the vegetables that I have here, but yeah. It happens all over. I mean, my parents, when they moved here to the U.S., they were using probably different vegetables in these same recipes mm-hmm. than what they grew up having in India, too. Mm. So I think that it's just kind of a natural progression, and it's also a it's not so far from
the way
that this food is cooked anyway. It's just that I have these other different vegetables maybe that
But then again, you do have like a lot of recipes here that have unique ingredients like the bitter gourd,
which
isn't exactly your daily, household staple, supermarket produce aisle, thing here in the States. So.
Yeah,
so there's a blend,
yes, but definitely.
And you combine like flavors and vegetables in a really interesting way. Like, so for the sour gazpacho and, applications, I guess you could say.
So it'd be like influences too, just from like living in New York. I mean, cause we have so much, so many different, cuisines here. So I did pull from some of those as well.
Yeah. Like I was remembering the vangi bath cauliflower.
Yeah.
Am I saying that right, first of all?
Yeah.
Vangi bath. Okay. And it's an eggplant dish, right?
Yes.
Vangi bath.
Yeah.
But you use the powder from it, their spice blend, to roast some cauliflower in, which looks beautiful in this book. But I just have vivid memories of us cooking large quantities of this for and like we couldn't get the oven hot enough or something. And then they were like kind of like sad and soggy instead of crispy.
We also use butternut. I think we use butternut squash and cauliflower in that.
We did.
Yeah.
So you could also do that when you come across this vangi bath cauliflower dish. And I'm sure it'll be much better than when we first.
I think it was on top of some farro. We've served it on top of farro instead of rice. Because usually vangi bath is an eggplant rice.
Yeah. And I think we must have made way too much because I have vivid memories of like having leftovers of this for like weeks.
Yes, probably. I think I just remember you coming in with a lot of butternut squash.
Oopsie. Nothing wrong with that, right?
No.
It's good for your... and also, okay, so one of you and your husband Ben's hallmarks is whenever you come to the party, you have a huge tub, and I mean like this plastic, like, I don't know, I'm like holding, like, it's bigger than a globe.
It's
anyway.
It's the biggest Tupperware ever.
It's the biggest Tupperware that exists, and it is full of this popcorn. It's in this book, and it's called Ben's Popcorn.
Yes.
And I love the story behind that. Can you tell how that was born?
So I, when Ben and I first started dating, I taught him how to make some of the recipes, like South Indian recipes, because he was really into just kind of like learning. I think the first thing I taught him how to make was the lemon peanut rice, which is in the book, which he actually made this week too. So he got really into it. And so like the tempering of spices is a big kind of lesson to learn before you make a lot of these dishes.
Tempering, you mean like you melt some oil and then you put the spices in?
Yeah. So it's basically like flavoring the oil with these spices. And so I taught him about hing, black mustard seeds, and the curry leaves. So he loves to make popcorn, and he basically flavored the butter for popcorn using those same spices. And then he threw in his own nutritional yeast. He's like, of course.
Yeah.
And then, we love it. We still take it to the movies, and we also take it to everybody's house.
That popcorn is really good, but it's like the perfect application of your spices and I guess popcorn. Do they eat popcorn in India?
Yeah, you'll find it in it's like kind of like street food. You'll see like a big kettle kind of popping corn, and then you can buy it on the street.
Nice. There's so many more things to discover, I'm sure. We're only scratching the you are just, you know, scratching the surface of all the applications, and it's exciting. So, okay, so what can the average person do to, I guess, prepare economy or like their pantry, get their pantry ready for all these things? I know. Okay, so I'm looking at this image of this spice tin.
Yeah.
And I've never had a spice tin, but everybody I know who is Indian has always had one.
Yes.
And it's this perfect like little round thing. It's a container in which you put all these containers of your own spices.
Except for hing, because it's too
sticky.
It's too smelly.
Leave
that in its original container.
And do you put it in the fridge? You hide it?
No, I just leave it in its own.
Hing is also asafoetida, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
There's so many different words for things. I've eaten a lot of your food. I think I've eaten a lot of Indian food, but even like me, I'm just kind of like overwhelmed. I'm like, what should I do with all these spices? How should I best? What's the point of this spice tin thing?
So I think it actually plays a large part in when you're tempering spices in mm-hmm. oil, because you're basically putting in a number of spices in quick succession into the oil.
Uh-huh.
So this spice tin comes in handy.
You take like a painter's palette.
Exactly.
You go like,
oh, that's a good way to look at it. Yeah.
Like Bob Ross. Like,
Exactly. And I actually have, two. I have one with South Indian spices and one with North Indian spices. too. So I know, but with this book, I mean, I try to really, and when I teach cooking classes too, mm-hmm. I try and introduce the fewest amount of spices also in order to cook like a rice, a yogurt, a salad, a dal dish or a lentil dish. And I kind of like stuck to that in the book as well.
Yeah.
So you'll find that a lot of the recipes are kind of like based in this same way of frying like a few spices and then starting the dish.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is like a nice little kit then to have and just... It'll be your mise en place, I guess, when you're doing those first steps. Okay, now it all makes more sense now. I just need to get one of these.
You can buy those online, too, or at the Indian shops.
Yeah, yeah. And the spices themselves, too.
Yeah.
Which you can get online. You could also get Brooklyn Deli online, too, at brooklyndelhi.com. Okay, so your book is all vegetarian. You've been a lifelong vegetarian, and I'm sure everyone is saying or asking you, I don't see tofu or like, I don't know, what is it called? Like seitan or something.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you get enough protein?
So lentils and beans and yogurt. So, this cuisine is centuries old, right? So mm-hmm. people in my family have been vegetarian for that long. And I feel like the cuisine has been honed for nutrition and uh-huh. for taste as well. And so it's balanced in that mm-hmm. sense. I guess I've been getting that question, since I was like a little kid even.
Of course, yeah, no, but I love that, you really back it up. Do you think that there's a growing interest? Well, of course there's a growing interest in eating more or less meat, I guess, and mm-hmm. legumes. But is there a growing interest now in South Indian vegetarian cooking that you've seen?
I mean, I think that, for instance, there's been a boom in people that are practicing yoga. Mm. And there's also been, I think, as a result, there's also been an interest in people kind of wanting to understand the cuisine mm-hmm. behind the culture
and
as well.
It rather than just tasting it from a dosa card.
Yeah,
really, too.
Yeah, totally. So I think it goes hand in hand, but also there is a growing population of people, I think, that are trying to follow a vegan, vegetarian, like gluten-free diet, and I feel like mm-hmm. it lends itself to that.
Yeah, and it's been around for much longer than some of these newfangled trends, too. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Paleo. It's definitely
meat.
Not paleo.
It's definitely not, I don't think paleo is vegan, though.
No.
I'm not even sure what's that. Well, okay, so Chitra, this book is beautiful, and it's coming out on Tuesday.
Yep.
And what are you going to do to celebrate?
On Wednesday, I'm having a party at Green Grape Annex in Fort Greene, 7 to 9, and there's going to be, actually that popcorn is going to be there.
Nice.
We're going to have appetizers, and I'll be there signing books, and you can buy a book there. And
get
we'll
a
have,
signed book?
Yeah.
Awesome. And so Green Grape Annex in Brooklyn. Anywhere
yes.
else?
I think that I'm just
country,
that's
for,
just
for now.
For
yeah.
now,
yeah.
just because I have this baby coming.
Chitra has another arrival, and in a month or so.
Yeah.
So two babies at once, book baby and real baby.
Yep.
What an exciting time. Well, thank you so much for joining us again here on Heritage Radio Network. And I couldn't be more excited for this book. I hope everyone checks out Vibrant India now from 10 Speed. Thanks, Chitra.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.